Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing that one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Don Moncrief, who's the founding director of A Well-Fed World, a hunger relief and animal protection organization based in Washington, D.C. That's coming up a little later, but first some news.
From One Green Planet, some of us were first introduced to the cruelty involved in the dog racing industry from an early episode of The Simpsons, when the family rescues a greyhound who was discarded by his owner at the racetrack after losing a race. Since then, dog racing has become less and less popular, with many tracks worldwide forced to shut down due to lack of attendance. Although this is ultimately wonderful news for dogs used in the racing industry, it also means the retired dogs can likely meet the tragic fate of euthanasia. Sadly, this is just the case at a racing track in Macau, where 650 greyhounds face death in the upcoming months. These dogs reside in the Macau Canine Drome, which has ended its dog racing, but it's infamous for their inhumane treatment of the dogs. In just 1 year, 383 dogs were killed by the Canine Drome, and animal advocates are worried the same fate will meet the remaining 650 dogs. A petition has been set up on care2.com to get the Macau government to intervene and send these dogs to a reputable rescue organization where they can then be adopted out to loving homes. Please take a moment to sign the petition at care2.com and add your voice to this important cause.
The United States Senate signed a budget agreement earlier this month to grant $1 billion to the dairy and livestock industries. The funds will be used towards programs that will help the dairy industry recover from a long-standing slump in dairy prices, which are affected by a number of factors, including consumer habits. Consumption of dairy products has dropped 25% in the last 20 years and is expected to continue to decline. This handout to the dairy industry is nothing new. For decades, agribusiness has been pulling levers in the U.S. Capitol, and billions of our tax dollars have been wasting in propping up our antiquated dairy industry, one of the most deeply entrenched interests in Washington, D.C. Americans are increasingly purchasing plant-based alternatives instead of animal-based milk. But the dairy industry has failed to adjust to the shift. In the first 8 months of 2016, dairy farmers nationwide dumped 43 million gallons of excess milk into manured lagoons and onto fields, with the surplus reaching an all-time high of 78 million gallons in 2017. Dairy sales have consistently declined for several years, which has led to a number of companies re-strategizing their brands to stay competitive with vegan alternatives. Danone, which was known for its yogurt brands, recently completed the acquisition of White Wave Foods, the parent company of the plant-based brands Silk, Vega, and So Delicious. While Elmhurst, New York City's last remaining dairy processor, abandoned the dairy business and now exclusively produces milks made from nuts.
After a 29-year delay, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service recently protected the Texas hornshell, a species of mussels from the Rio Grande and its tributaries, as endangered under the Endangered Species Act. The last surviving native freshwater mussel in New Mexico, the hornshell is threatened by plans for a new dam, pollution, and diminishing water in rivers due to global warming and agricultural and municipal use. According to Michael Robinson at the Center of Biological Diversity, this unique mussel now has an excellent chance of survival in the face of a would-be dam builders and polluters thanks to the Endangered Species Act. This is good news for the horseshoe and for all of us who rely on clean water and find solace and peace in rivers that still flow, Michael followed with. The Endangered Species Act has been tremendously successful, saving 99% of the animals and plants under its protection from extinction and putting hundreds on the road to recovery. Five remaining populations of the Texas hornshell persist in the U.S. In the Black River of southeastern New Mexico, the Pecos and Devils Rivers in Texas, and two populations on the lower Rio Grande. While the mussel appears abundant in stretches of the Black River and Rio Grande, only three old male mussels could be recently found in the Pecos River, with no females and no young located. A sixth population that had been reintroduced in the Delaware River in New Mexico may have been wiped out in August 2017 when 18,000 gallons of wastewater from oil and gas production, alongside with 11 gallons of oil, spilled into the river from a ruptured pipeline. The water is still too contaminated to safely allow surveys for the mussel. In addition to the threat of pollution and diminishing water due to climate change and increasing human demands, the Texas hornshell is also in peril by plans for a dam near Laredo, Texas. The mussels require flowing water in order to reproduce. To learn more, go to biologicaldiversity.org.
Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with Don Moncrief, who is the founding director of A Well-Fed World, a hunger relief and animal protection organization. Don is also a founding board director for the organization Beyond Carnism and serves as board advisor for the International Fund for Africa, Food for Life Global, Help Animals India, Grow Where You Are, the Pollination Project, and the Center for Effective Vegan Advocacy. That's coming up next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on ACT Radio is Don Moncrief. Thanks for being with us, Don.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thank you.
Don, can you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
Yeah, I actually come from the hunger perspective originally. So that's what I had planned to work on in grad school. I was in D.C. and planned to work at the World Bank and work on global hunger issues. I had been vegetarian since about 19 because I cared about animals, but I didn't know about veganism. I didn't know about the harm of dairy and eggs and how that's actually worse for animals than eating animals directly for their flesh. But someone who was vegan mentioned to me, like, if you care about animals, then you should be vegan. And I was really upset because, I didn't even know what it was. I thought I was good being a vegetarian, like, you know, a lot of people. And this was 1998, so there wasn't the same kind of option. So certainly I researched it because I wasn't letting somebody just come after my pizza and ice cream without looking into it a little bit. As I was working on the global hunger issues and the devastation that animal agriculture causes, you know, more and more those connections became clear with the environmental devastation and resource depletion and the exporting of crops from low-income countries where people are hungry to make meat products for wealthier countries. And so it just all came together. And there weren't enough people on the hunger side of it actually working on the issues. They acknowledged it was a problem but said that meat was demand-driven and wouldn't advocate for reduced meat consumption, even among the world's highest meat consumers like the U.S. And so that's how I realized, like, that's the area I really need to focus on is bringing attention to the fact that meat is not demand-driven, it's production-driven, and that, you know, taking steps to reduce, ideally eliminate, animal-sourced food consumption is really going to be helpful on global hunger issues. And so that's what we work on. And just also to be clear, because a lot of times it's framed as if veganism will solve world hunger, and it won't solve world hunger, but it will reduce the price pressure because it reduces demand for overall food crops, and it also reduces demand to pull the resources away from low-income countries and helps on the resource and environmental issues. So there is a direct connection, but veganism won't solve world hunger.
Well,
but it's a critical piece to it.
Okay, well, it will make things better for the hungry of the world, won't it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So that's one of the things. It's not just idea that, like, when your mom tells you, eat all your food because people are hungry in another country. So,
yeah.
You know, it's not just this kind of vague idea of if we eat less, then those resources automatically go to those countries, because that's not the case. There's a lot of pieces in between. But with supply and demand, it does take the pressure off by reducing the demand. So there's less competition. And basically, it bids up the price of even the basic staples, food staples. And we saw this during the 2008 food crisis, where there is a contraction in supply, and then the prices skyrocket, and people die, like, of not being able to get access to food. And so when you're that poor, a little bit of a price increase means a big difference. But conversely, if we reduce pressure on the food system, reduce our intake of crops to feed animals, to feed wealthier meat-eating populations, then that increase of resources can feed a lot of people and reduce global hunger. And it just it needs to be a part of the equation, and it's not being.
Right. Well, I think, you know, they don't want to think about how their diet affects humans. You know, some people are willing to forego, you know, the animals that are abused or the environmental impact with pollution and runoff and, you know, these cesspools of manure and all this sort of thing. But, you know, they don't want to think about, you know, they say, well, I care about animals. And I know one of the things that I've heard a lot is, you know what, we already have enough food to feed, you know, the 7 billion people on the earth. So why should I change my diet? And I'm curious how you tend to respond to a critique like that.
Sure. Thank you. That's a great point, because people do say that. And people say that just from sound bites and don't understand where numbers are coming from. And so what that's based on is the amount of crops produced globally. And this is one of our points. There's more than enough food produced globally, if we were actually using that food to feed people directly, more than 9 billion people. So with the population concerns and things of that nature, that's a really important point. But what's happening, there's this trade-off of scarcity versus distribution. So they'll say, it's not scarcity, it's distribution. And usually what people think about that then is that it's some kind of, you know, within the country, there's not roadways or storage and things of that nature, which is a problem for a lot. But really, the bigger problem is the redistribution of those crop resources into livestock feed. And we're talking about heavy concentrations of feed conversion ratios of how much more it takes to feed an animal than if we were to eat crops directly. So, you know, people who have followed this know that animals are very inefficient converters of crops into meat. And it's actually even worse than people think. So you got to think of the redistribution. So there's plenty of food, but it's being concentrated and redistributed and given to animals, and that's why it does matter. And then this is also increasingly a problem, so that if we were to say, okay, say right now we did actually have enough for everybody, but increasingly pollution is a concern. Climate change is reducing crop yields. We have increasingly less land, increasingly less arable land, increasingly more people. So as those constraints come on supply, then the prices increase and we have fewer and fewer calories to share. But even now, it's being redistributed to wealthier populations and for livestock feed. And I do want to go back to feed conversion ratios at some point, because the numbers that we typically hear for people who follow this are greatly underestimated.
Oh.
Can you give us an update on that then, Dawn? Because we do always hear those numbers repeated over and over. And I've always been curious about how they're calculated and then also how the water use is calculated, because that's also kind of controversial.
Yeah. So when it comes to feed conversion ratios, and we have this on our website, awfw.org, there is a section on climate and a section on feed ratios where it spells it out. And we actually use numbers from Vlachov Shumil, and he is a researcher. He does a lot on studying meat, but he's actually not even a vegetarian or vegan, which he should be based on his research. But if he at least puts out the information honestly. People who follow typically within the vegetarian and vegan communities, you'll hear 2-to-1 for chickens, 7-to-1 for pigs, and 16-to-1 for cows. And for people who don't follow this, what that means is that it takes 200 calories of feed to make 100 calories of chicken, or 700 calories for pigs to make 100 calories of pork, or 1,600 calories of crops to make 100 calories of beef. So those are the standard numbers. And why those are underestimates, the industry uses more conservative numbers. They use like 2-to-1 for chickens, kind of maybe in the 4 or 4.5 for pigs, and then they say 7 for cows. But there's a difference between live weight ratios, butcher weight, and then edible. And this is a really important distinction. And so for researchers and advocates and people who are actually care about the issue, we have to focus on the edible loss of food, the edible inefficiencies. And so if you're just focusing on live weight, that's how much an animal gain. So for every pound of crop or 16 pounds of crop, they gain 1 pound of weight for cows, so they say. But after you take out the bones and blood and the secretions, then you get the butcher weight, and which is a carcass, also known as like a carcass weight. Then when you further take it out, you take out the fat, you cut it into pieces and take out all the pieces people don't want to eat, and you get it packaged and into the grocery stores, that's the edible weight. Hmm. And that's actually, with our research, we have it online with linked, is 25 to 1 for cows.
Wow.
So it like between doubles and triples. So again, the industry says 7, 16 is what you've heard in vegetarian communities for a while, but it's 25 to 1 for cows.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. And again, considering all the other terrible consequences of raising livestock, it just makes it even harder for people to think about how does this guy that did the research justify continuing to eat, to eat beef?
You know, well, they like it, right? Like, I don't want to eat, I Ben & Jerry's, you know, vegan ice cream. I don't want to eat the ice cream, but diet change is hard. So people, there's a lot about veganism being easy, and when you're when you're motivated ethically, that's a big help. Or for health, but whatever the reasons. But this is interesting. So I actually read this study, is that people are different on their compulsion for food, and that some people don't have a strong compulsion about the types of food that they eat, and it's very easy for them to make diet change, while others are extremely compelled, and then most people are in the spectrum somewhere, and so there's varying degrees of how hard diet change is for people. And I try to use my own struggles with sugar to make me a little more sympathetic, but
yeah, exactly.
But it is tough because you're talking about destroying the world and the extreme suffering of animals and global hunger. So I'm not trying to be an apologist, but just trying to make clear that these issues are, you know, complicated for individuals sometimes, and but there's a lot of work to be done, and it's extremely important to do it.
You know, I don't know if it's true or not, but what I've read is that most fish are now farmed, and it takes more fish to feed the fish that are farmed. They have to scoop up all kinds of sea life to feed the farmed fish, and that's also wasteful.
Yeah, it is. It's a huge problem that doesn't get enough attention, and what it's doing to our oceans, which are part of the one of the main things that we have for climate change to try to help with the greenhouse gases. So when we're destroying our oceans, we're further intensifying climate change. And when you're talking about the waste, one of the points I wanted to make around that, and it also plays back to the scarcity versus distribution issue. So if we had enough food, then it really wouldn't matter so much. We wouldn't really have much of an argument about wasting food for the animals, because we would know that there's plenty. But food waste is a big issue. People understand that food waste is important. Nobody argues against food waste. And in fact, one of the lead people at the United Nations in charge of global hunger issues called the diversion of crops for biofuels a crime against humanity. And biofuels take up less than 5% of crop production, whereas livestock take up about a third.
Yeah.
So he's calling that a crime against humanity. If we reduce meat consumption on a global level, we could easily have enough for biofuels and feeding people in better ways. So, you know, people get that food waste is a problem, but they don't put it together. And especially when you have a statement that's strong. And one of the things about food waste that people like to focus on is that we lose maybe like a third to a half sometimes. And, you know, it's outrageous. If we were to think we're losing half of our food to food waste, people are in an uproar. But when we talk about chickens having a 2-to-1 ratio, we're losing half the food to make chicken meat. And they're celebrating that as the greatest efficiency. So it doesn't make sense. There's this disconnect between wasting half our food is horrific and a crime against humanity, and then with chickens, it's celebrated as efficiency. And as I just talked about, the 2-to-1 is actually the industry ratio talking about live weight. When we go to the edible weight, I didn't say what it was for chickens, but for chickens, it's about 4 to 4.5 times. So they eat 400 calories for 100 calories of chicken meat. And we shouldn't consider this an upgrade in nutrients. So this is protein and calories, and there's opportunity cost in what could be produced instead of livestock feed. So it's a really important issue on those types of regards, and not shouldn't be considered a trading up. And just briefly on livestock, I want to say I use that term because it's controversial, because, you know, to demean animals and to treat them as livestock. But I don't want to distinguish between factory farming and smaller farming. And if you use the term animal agriculture, it sounds almost nice. It's kind of still has that kind of idyllic feel of animal agriculture. So I do use the term livestock and livestock industry just to kind of hit home and to be inclusive of all types of animal farming and animal food.
I have a question about these ratios. Have you guys calculated any of them for like dairy products? Like you said, a lot of people struggle being vegetarian to make the step to go vegan because of cheese and milk and all these other
yogurt.
Yeah, yogurt. And so I was curious, are there similar ratios for dairy products and eggs and other animal products?
There are. I should have that information more handy, and I'm sorry that I don't. But one thing that I'd like to point out with regards to dairy, because we have a lot of people who are vegetarian who are maybe on the cusp about being vegan, and even if the animal issues themselves aren't the motivator, if they aren't either able or willing, you know, to look at the issues around the horrible things that we do to cows to get dairy, if they're concerned about climate change, dairy is one of the worst foods. Cheese is one of the worst foods in particular because it's concentrated dairy. And cattle, so cows, goats, any kind of ruminant animal, emits more greenhouse gases if they're grass-fed. So this is the other argument for people who feel like they're doing good by the environment by eating foods that are from grass-fed cattle, be it dairy or meat. And there are some benefits in terms of pollution, but in terms of climate, it's actually worse, because when cows eat grass, they emit 3 to 4 times more methane. Hmm. And methane is a super powerful greenhouse gas. Mm-hmm. And this is another thing where people hear numbers, but they don't understand where those numbers are coming from. So the typical numbers that people who study this will hear is it's about 23 times more powerful. That's the number they gave back in 2006 with Livestock's Long Shadow that kind of got the vegetarian and vegan movements focused on these issues. But the range sometimes is between 20 to 25 times more potent of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. So if you just think like, oh, it's twice as much, that's a big deal. If it's 10 times as much, that's a big deal. But we're talking 20, 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide. But here's the catch. That's over a 100-year time frame. Mm-hmm. And we don't have 100 years. If you look at the potency of methane over a 20-year time frame, it's actually 84 times more powerful of a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. And so what that means is that when you have cows who are the top emitter within animal agriculture of methane, about 37% globally is the last number I saw on that, of all emissions, then that is coming in at 84 times more mm-hmm. powerful than the carbon dioxide. So that's why grass-fed beef and dairy that comes from grass-fed cattle are so problematic. Hmm. And the trade-off, unfortunately, and this argument then is being used to fuel factory farming. So if they're being factory farmed, they're not having those greater emissions because they're being fed cereals, which is not their natural diet. And then their greenhouse emissions are about the same as other animals, because it's by pound, because the greenhouse, the climate impact is more about carbon dioxide and all the processes that go into factory farming, transportation and things like that are the bigger indicator. And if we were to change it to five years, that ratio goes, that potency goes up to 100 times more potent. And these aren't disputed. That 84 number comes from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the global governing body. So, we really work to use statistics that are coming from research sources that aren't going to be
biased,
controversial. I'm not saying our sources are biased. I'm just saying they can be called that. So, you know, we use, and those tend to be conservative. And anytime you're getting the mainstream numbers, you can consider that they're probably conservative, but we still need to, you know, use those and just make caveats as we know them.
You know, carbon dioxide is taken out of the air by plants and trees and whatnot, but I don't suppose methane has any way of being reabsorbed into the environment, right?
Well, the thing about methane, though, that is on the upside is that it has a shorter half-life than carbon dioxide. So if we cut those emissions, it makes an impact on the greenhouse gases in the air much quicker. But yes, to your point about plants, this is the other problem, the other part of the equation when we're talking about grass-fed animals, is that the deforestation that happens pulls trees out of the system, and that's what we need for photosynthesis. That's one of our main sources, along with the ocean, that actually helps us proactively pull greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, out of the atmosphere. And so we're cutting them down to make grazing pasture for animals, or we're cutting them down so that we can grow crops for feed on these monocultures.
Mm-hmm. Don, I want to go back to what you mentioned about crimes against humanity and actually the concept of hunger. Some of the numbers on the website for A Well-Fed World talk about more than 6,000 children dying of malnutrition every day. We have obviously millions of people in the U.S. facing chronic hunger. The website says more than 840 million people is counted as suffering from chronic hunger. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what your organization is doing to try and fight this epidemic of chronic hunger.
Well, two things. So first, education and awareness, and bring these issues so that people make the connections. It's mildly important, I guess, on a general public level, just so people know, but it tends to actually not be a strong motivator in the U.S. for people to make the change on a personal level. So the bigger impact is if we can get people within the global hunger community to take that seriously and at least get it on the agenda as part of the equation of what people can do, and to try to affect policies that maybe would subsidize things or not subsidize the other things, subsidize the right things, stop subsidizing the wrong things. And also just to say reduced consumption is important, and to start putting pressure on the global community, or at least making recommendations, if not pressure, to move in that direction and to bring more awareness to the harms. Except they do bring awareness to the harm of increasing global meat consumption, but they don't recommend reducing consumption. What they do recommend is trying to increase yield using technology so that there's more resources available, and to decrease population. And then the other thing we do on an immediate schedule are our programs that we have. We help feeding programs that are in their community. So we don't go into communities and bring feeding programs. My joke is I don't really know how to cook that well. I don't know how to grow anything. Well, we're not an imperialist model going in and putting our model in. I wouldn't even know how to do that. But we find groups in their own communities doing really important work that is plant-based, and we provide funding for that. So we do grants. Our fundraising efforts are usually like 100% that go to the groups. One of the ones I'm most proud of that we're going to be increasing this year is called Plants for Hunger. And this is available year-round, and we have four groups in Ethiopia, India, Guatemala, and the U.S., and it focuses on children. So they're all plant-based vegan feeding groups focusing on children, and we raise money and we split it equally between the four, and we don't take any of the resources, and usually in November and or December we do a matching to take out of our general fund to help raise money, because people really like to do it as gifts. We have it set up as a gift giving because people like to give feeding programs as gifts. And so this gives an alternative to using meat-based feeding programs or the live animal programs, the Heifer International, for example. So we're looking to expand that even further this year, and also to expand our information campaign against Heifer International. That's also on our website. We have a list of about a dozen things that's wrong with Heifer International so that people can speak out against it. A lot of people in the vegetarian vegan community obviously don't like Heifer International, but they don't have the talking points. So we make that easy. And then we offer the Plants for Hunger as the alternative. And the Ethiopian School Lunch Program is the one that's especially dear to me. So I've been there. I know them. And we spend a lot of time partnering with them to have bakeries in the schools, food gardens in the schools, and they're dedicated vegan activists who also care about animals. It's really just amazing work, and it's good to be able to do something directly, because the other work is very important top-down on making structural change, but it's long-term. And this gives an immediate doing good for people and children in particular without harming animals. And it's, you know, it's good that we can have that. We don't have to have that trade-off. And it also shows, hey, vegans, we care about people too.
Yeah, that's right. Well, we've been talking with Don Moncrief, the founding director of A Well-Fed World. You can learn more about their programs by going to the website awfw.org. Thanks for being with us and for your time today, Dawn.
Thank you so much. Oh, by the way, those gifts, they happen year-round. They're great birthday gifts, too, and you can just donate directly. It doesn't have to be a gift.
Great. Sounds good. Thanks, Dawn. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, Dawn. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you're looking to learn more about a plant-based diet, you can take a short trip to Albuquerque, New Mexico for the Red and Green Veg Fest taking place on Saturday, March 10th. At the Veg Fest, you'll see chef demonstrations, taste amazing food, mix and mingle, and check out the exhibit hall, which will be filled with cruelty-free products and services available to you.
And more locally, there's information about vegetarian and vegan diets available at the website of the Vegetarian Society of El Paso, vsep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to the past shows of ACT Radio, you'll find them at ktep.org. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Lenny.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.